course, my job as director of the Financial Markets Group, first of all, to tell you who I am, my name's David Webb. And the lecture that we've got today is a lecture by Hayne Leyland. We're very proud to have him here to give what we hope might become an annual event. Last year, Stephen Ross of Yale University presented a lecture about this time of year on some issues to do with behavioral finance. Today we have Hayne Leyland, who's going to give a lecture today about some aspects of bond pricing and risk management. But obviously Hayne's going to tell you what he's got to say. My job is in a sense just to tell you who Hayne is. Well, Hayne Leyland will be known very well to the students in the audience and to some of the practitioners. Some of you will actually know him indirectly, and I'll get to that in a moment. But at the moment, Hayne is the Arno Rayner Professor of Finance at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. He also serves as director of the Berkeley Program in Finance. Prior to going to Berkeley, he taught economics at Stanford University. And prior to that, he did his BA and PhD degrees in economics at Harvard, and indeed has an MSc in economics from the London School of Economics. And I have to say that Hayne, I went to a seminar by Hayne back in the, I think it was the late 70s, when I believe he actually came back to the school. Since then, since getting his PhD, Hayne has produced numerous articles in investment theory and the uses of derivatives in investment management. That's a slightly modest statement because Hayne's contribution to economic theory in general is quite a vast one. And I remember as a graduate student reading a large number of his papers and telling us how to understand the analysis of risk in general in economic decision making. And Hayne wrote some of the early papers in asymmetric information, some of which I know I was influenced by, and I know students today are influenced by them. However, one of Hayne's great achievements was to be a founding principal of Leyland O'Brien Rubinstein, otherwise known as LOR. And as a result of the activities of that particular organization in the 1980s, he was named Fortune Magazine's Businessman of the Year in 1987. Of course, 1987 was a famous year for stock markets. That was the year of the crash, and Hayne, I think, along with his colleagues, was partly blamed for that in the famous Brady Report, in which they claimed the work that Hayne and his firm had done on portfolio insurance was partly contributed to the market crash. Although I have to say, I thought it was particularly admirable that only moments after the crash, Hayne wrote an article explaining why the market had crashed, and that appeared somewhat later as a wonderful paper with Gerard Genot in the American Economic Review. And that, I think, is one of the best papers ever to understand how price and quantity information affects market prices and how to think about an equilibrium in which a real phenomenon, in this case portfolio insurance, affects prices in a way that ties in with the facts. And that's a paper that I think the economics profession can be proud of, and a paper that we to this day teach to our more advanced students. So without carrying on and giving you a sort of a breakdown of Hayne's citations count, etc., which is pretty enormous, it's a pleasure to introduce Hayne, who has just stood down, should I say, as president of the American Finance Association. But at the time that our information was circulated, I believe he was still the president of the American Finance Association. So, welcome, Hayne, and the lecture lasts for about an hour.
Thank you. Okay. Does this seem to be working properly? Can everybody hear me? Okay. Thank you, David, for that kind introduction. I didn't mean to cut you short. This is really quite a happy homecoming for me in some ways. I was an MSc student here back in the mid-60s, And indeed, much of the place looks very familiar. About the only major change has been the price level. But it is a pleasure to be back here and to talk to what I've been told is a rather mixed audience. I'm not going to give a particularly technical talk, but for those of you who are techies, I'll try to at least hint at some of the techniques involved. And for those of you who might like a copy of the paper that underlies this talk, I suggest you reach me through email at LSE. I'm H. Leland at lse.ac.uk. So I'm happy to oblige any requests for papers at that point. Now, I think it's fair to say that the last two decades have been simply splendid for my field, financial economics. What started as a seemingly arcane theory, option pricing, has swept not only the academic thinking, but most surprisingly, the real world as well. The success of option pricing theory is based on its ability to accurately price and hedge derivative securities and to create new tools for risk management. Loved or hated, derivatives have become essential to the world's financial markets, and option pricing theory is essential to derivatives. How our profession has basked, I might say, in its success. Our ideas are not only listened to, but actually sought out. Financial institutions have established the likes of the Solomon Center for Finance at NYU, the Witter Foundation for Financial Research at Berkeley, and I believe have importantly supported the Financial Markets Group at LSE. Indeed, the Swedes have seen fit to award Robert Merton and Myron Scholes an important prize, one they would have shared, by the way, with Fisher Black if he were still living. But before entering into a state of complete euphoria, it should be noticed that some other branches of academic finance have lagged by comparison. A most notable laggard, I would argue, is corporate finance. While many interesting qualitative theories have been developed in the last two decades, in stark contrast with the precision of option pricing theory, corporate finance has remained distressingly imprecise. Yes, we can state certain things. Firms that have riskier activities should have smaller amounts of debt. That's hardly news to the typical corporate treasurer. She wants to know whether gearing should be 32% or 46% or 63%. And in its current state, corporate finance cannot readily provide that precision of an answer. Well, what do we know? Rigorous thinking on corporate financial structure began with the work of Modigliani and Miller in the late 50s. This literature assumed that the firm could alter its gearing, or leverage, as I will probably slip into since that's the U.S. term, it can alter its gearing without changing what it actually does, its investment decisions, including the risk of those investment decisions. In a world in which the firm's activities are independent of its financial structure, M&M showed that financial structure matters only if there are non-firm claimants to the firm's cash flows. In the presence of taxes and default costs, gearing should minimize the net outflow of value to these external claimants. And virtually every basic textbook in finance has a diagram showing firm value as a function of debt or gearing. And we'll see if we can find one of those kinds of diagrams. I hope you can see this. This was cribbed directly this morning from a very well-known introductory textbook in corporate finance, whose co-author resides a little bit to the north of LSE. And in this diagram, what you see is that firm value, as we increase along the x-axis, the debt ratio, or gearing ratio, firm value initially rises with debt because of the tax shelter that interest payments provide. As gearing increases, you see that default costs become more and more significant and firm value begins to fall back down. And you will note in this diagram, as in virtually every other corporate finance textbook, we see optimal debt ratio. The only problem is there are no numbers attached to that. You notice they don't start at zero. Well, they might go to 100%, but exactly where that maximum occurs is left imprecise. And that really is, I think, the Achilles heel of corporate finance and why it is not paid as much attention to by corporate treasurers as derivatives theory is paid to by traders in capital markets. Now, why has corporate finance been such a laggard in terms of developing precise quantitative theories? I think the answer is it's because it's a tougher question, actually, than options. To get quantitative answers, we must first be able to price risky debt accurately. Optimal gearing obviously depends on the price at which debt can be sold. But this is a hard problem. At a minimum, the value of corporate bonds will depend on interest rates on government securities, what we might call the risk-free rate, plus those items which determine credit spreads due to default risk. Credit spreads clearly depend at least on the following: the amount of debt or gearing ratio that the firm currently has. Credit spreads on debt will also depend on the maturity of the debt issued, the asset value of the firm, the recovery rate on principal value if liquidation or restructuring occurs, the covenants that may trigger default, the dividend payout rate, because after all, the more dividends that are paid to equity holders, the less money available to bondholders. The firm's tax rate also becomes important in the value of corporate debt. Of course, the firm's cash flows, and finally, and something we'll be coming back to and spending quite a bit of time on, the risk of the firm's activities. Now, a formula for debt value, presumably, must depend on all of these items. If you look at the people who try to price corporate bonds now, the people who perhaps are doing that most accurately are the bond rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, in the United States. And there seems to be a lot of hocus-pocus going on. Nobody knows quite how they combine these variables, but I think they would agree that the list of variables I gave were quite relevant. So to try to put all of these important items into a single formula for debt value makes Black-Scholes look like child's play by comparison. The good news is that recently some significant progress has been made. While it may be premature to announce victory, I think there is a good hope that eventually corporate financial theory can be as useful to corporations as option pricing has been to capital markets. This afternoon, I'd like to give you a brief overview of this theory and some of its implications. I will include some recent results from my AFA presidential address, although, as I indicated, I will skip most of the fine points. These theories basically start with a firm that has assets generating cash flows. Those assets have a value which we'll denote by V. Starting at some level V0, say today, we'll normalize that to 100. And then the presumption is that this asset value will move a la Black-Scholes as a logarithmic Brownian motion with risk denoted by sigma, the standard deviation of returns. A typical number for asset value risk might be 20% per year. Since firms are typically geared, the equity risk will tend to be higher, reflecting the leverage or gearing associated with debt. These assets produce a cash flow assumed to be proportional to asset value, so it too will follow, cash flow too will follow a log random walk with similar volatility. Early work along these lines followed Modigliani Miller in assuming that the firm's risk sigma is fixed at an exogenously given level and will not change with the level of debt, a point I'll return to later. The assumption of a random walk for asset values enables us to extend option pricing techniques to value corporate securities and debt in particular. After all, these securities are contingent claims on asset value. The theory of bond pricing was originally pioneered in Merton's 1974 paper on the risk structure of debt, which looked only at the very simple case of zero coupon debt. Extending analytic results to more realistic forms of debt has really taken another 20 years, but progress recently has been made. In particular, Klaus Toft and I, in the Journal of Finance in 1996, examined coupon-paying debt value, and we also included optimal capital structure using extensions of the basic Merton framework, but with taxes and bankruptcy costs and coupon-paying bonds, of course, introduced as well. To make things analytically tractable, we assumed that debt was continuously rolled over unless default occurred. That way, we had a stationary capital structure, even though debt had finite maturity. The fact is, as certain bonds matured, you were continuously rolling them over and replacing them with new bonds, so the overall maturity remained the same for the firm as a whole. Default was triggered when asset value fell to an endogenously determined level, which will asset value level, which we'll call VB, B for bankruptcy, at which point it was no longer, there wasn't enough value available for stockholders to want to continue to service the debt, since, of course, debt has a prior claim. Now, the formula that we derived for debt value is rather complex. This will be the one equation that you see on the board, but let me put it up there. So, on the top here, I don't know, that looks awfully faint even from here. I hope you can see it. I don't really want you to study this in great detail. I know it's final exam time, but I'm not going to quiz you on this afterwards. Anyway, here is the set of parameters that we're talking about, the current asset value V, which is, of course, moving like a random walk, debt defined in terms of its principal value P, its coupon C, which is a dollar rate through time, the debt maturity denoted by T, although you're continuously replacing debt, but each time you issue new debt, it's with maturity T, the firm's tax rate TAW, the payout rate to security holders, you can think of that roughly as a dividend, delta, and the risk sigma that I indicated describes the log random walk of the asset value V. We assume for simplicity a constant risk-free rate R, and that the debt recovery proportion in default is denoted by alpha. Now, when you look at the formula here, the first part looks pretty simple, indeed simpler than Black-Scholes, until you realize there are a couple of terms, IT and JT, that are integrals of terms which indeed look like rather complex Black-Scholes-like expressions with the cumulative standardized normal variable being given there in four different places. So essentially what I'm trying to show you is that the methodology of option pricing can, with a fair amount of work and complexity, be applied to figure out the value of corporate securities. Do these values make sense? Well, we've got one more diagram for the moment to look at. Based on this formula, we could look at the coupons that bonds would have to pay, and in particular at the difference between the government rate and the corporate rate that would have to be paid, where here we've listed maturity. Here are the credit spreads associated with the debt measured in basis points, which are hundredths of 1%. And the different lines occur for firms with different levels of leverage or gearing, and therefore different risks. So if a very risky firm tries to issue debt, at the short end, say 1 year, it will have to pay 8% or 800 basis points above the short-term risk-free rate. That same risky firm will actually pay less, but of course it's paying it for a longer period of time when we move out to a longer maturity debt. So for poor risks, poor credit risks, this line is essentially downward shaping. Whereas when we get down to firms with very low leverage, we find that the curve starts low, ends low, but has a slightly upward shaping shape. And in the middle, we find sort of a somewhat humped structure. Now, interestingly, a researcher, Varga, what's Andre? What is his first name? Sidipto, help me out. Okay. Mr. Varga did an empirical study of corporates and found exactly this kind of behavior as a function of risk and maturity being offered, that the low-risk firms tended to have a slightly upward term structure of credit spreads, and the high-risk had the declining ones, and in the middle there was this hump pattern. So, you know, I didn't suggest my theory had to provide these kinds of patterns, and it was rather reassuring to see that you could get the kind of complexity that real-world term structure of credit spreads seems to give. So, knowing the value of debt and equity, it's relatively straightforward to determine optimal capital structure. Here we see firm value now as a function of gearing. Here's the percent gearing or leverage on the x-axis. Here is the firm value on the y. It's assumed that every firm with no debt would start at a value of 100. So the maxima show you the kinds of advantage to leverage associated with the tax rate of 35% I've assumed here, and a lot of other parameters I really don't have time to go into. But these were chosen to try to be reasonably realistic. It looks like in going from no leverage to optimal leverage, if you're using very short-term debt, which is the bottom curve, you can realize benefits of about 4%. But if you're willing to use 20-year debt, the long-term debt allows you to take on more leverage. You don't have to repay it so often. And that gives you quite a bit more tax advantage, less bankruptcy cost associated with optimal gearing. Now, just contrast that with the figure in the typical textbook, where we have no idea where that optimum is. Well, at least they got the shape of the curve right, which is hardly surprising. But here we can see if a firm uses 20-year debt, it should have exactly 43% leverage, and we estimate that in order to float that debt, it'll have to pay approximately 55 basis points credit spread. Thus, the figure there displayed provides the exact quantification of the optimal amount of debt that figure one, the textbook figure, lacked. While offering much more precise advice than previous studies, this approach can be criticized in two dimensions. From an empirical point of view, it seems that the yield spread, I mentioned 55 basis points, seems a bit low relative to available data that we have. That is, real-world yield spreads seem to be somewhat greater than the amount we predicted here. Furthermore, the optimal gearing levels that we derive are certainly high relative to what we observe in the U.S. Gearing levels in the U.S. average about 35%, whereas our analysis suggests that maybe as much as 45% would be more appropriate, although we note that firms that use shorter-term debt should have lower levels of leverage than the 45% that's optimal for longer-term debt. From a theoretical point of view, the model assumes two things that I think need to be improved upon. They assume that debt is fixed once for all and then rolled over at that same level. So if the firm does well, it doesn't have the option to increase its level of debt. Presumably, in the real world, firms can issue greater amounts of debt through time. But generally, bonds have a covenant that prevent firms from watering down their value by issuing more debt. So it's not unusual that firms would have to call whatever debt might be outstanding before it issues new debt in greater amounts. So the first criticism of these kinds of models is that the debt level is static, And the second criticism, and the one that I'll be spending most of my time on here today, is that the risk level of the firm's investments is assumed to be constant. Remember I said that was a key part of the Modigliani-Miller approach that suggested risk is fixed. While consistent with Modigliani-Miller's arguments, the assumption of a constant risk sigma was first challenged directly by Jensen and Meckling in 1974 in their classic article on agency theory. Jensen and Meckling argued that it is incorrect to presume that a firm's risk choice would not depend on the amount of debt the firm has. Arguing on the loose analogy that equity was like an option in the firm's value, Jensen Meckling concluded that a firm with debt already in place would have an incentive to increase risk. By increasing risk, equity holders will have a greater upside potential, while the greater downside potential would be borne by the bondholders due to the limited liability of equity. Thus, by increasing risk, equity holders could benefit at bondholders' expense. Jensen and Meckling termed this phenomena asset substitution, substituting risky activities for less risky ones. In effect, the firm goes for broke, with the incentives particularly strong when the firm is close to default. Examples of such predatory behavior are not hard to find, from Penn Central and the savings and loans in the United States to Maxwell and Leeson in the UK, where taking additional risks at basically other people's expense was a nice game to play. When all else appeared to be desperate, why not go for broke? Of course, they did go broke. Now, rational bondholders, of course, will reflect the risk-taking incentives which gearing provides, and they'll demand higher interest rates and compensation. To just assume they're going to be hammered over the head time and time again, oh, thank goodness, they raised the risk, what a surprise, one would presume a rational expectations model, and one would want to factor in that into equilibrium. The net effect is that since higher interest rates will have to be paid, ex ante, the initial shareholders bear the expected cost of asset substitution, and this is, of course, termed a form of agency cost. Jensen and Meckling argued that agency costs of this sort are important in determining optimal capital structure. So a full theory of optimal gearing must conjointly study optimal risk-taking by the firm, as well as, of course, the optimal capital structure. And the model that I showed you before, even with that complex formula, didn't take this kind of feedback into account. So my current work seeks to unite the tax and default cost story of Modigliani and Miller with the agency cost concerns of Jensen and Meckling. It also uses some recent results by Bob Goldstein, Nengju Ju, and myself to include a dynamic capital structure so debt can be increased through time. Let me briefly outline the dynamic nature of debt. That's not the focus of the talk. I want to focus on risk, but let me just give you a brief idea of how we've introduced a dynamic strategy for debt. As I say, earlier models, including the formula developed in Figure 2, typically assume that debt principal and coupon remain fixed. In my recent work, building from earlier work by Fisher, Henkel, and Zechner, the firm will increase its debt if its asset value rises sufficiently to justify the restructuring cost. It's balancing the greater tax benefits. After all, default costs are less because the firm's doing well, so it now says tax benefits are more substantial than the worry about default costs. Let's increase the amount of debt. We don't do this continuously because there is a fixed transactions cost. Actually, it's a proportional transactions cost, but you've got to call all the debt before new increased amounts of debt can be issued. So to restructure, the firm calls in its current debt at par, could be at a premium, but I've assumed par, when asset value rises sufficiently to an endogenously determined value, VU. And it immediately issues an increased amount of new debt. When restructuring occurs, the homothetic of all of this implies that the amount of debt will be scaled up exactly in proportion to the increase in asset value. Namely, it will be scaled up by the ratio VU, the restructuring asset value, relative to V0, the initial asset value when debt was first issued. The firm could restructure an arbitrary number of times in this model as long as it hasn't previously defaulted. Note that the lower the value of VU, lower values of VU will be reached more quickly. We're starting at V0, this thing's wandering around like a random walk, and if VU isn't much above V0, of course, we're going to bounce into it. The first passage time will be shorter, and therefore, on average, one would expect more frequent restructuring, which in turn means that debt that's issued will have shorter expected maturity, since it will be called more often. The more technically challenging problem is to handle this endogenously chosen and changing risk levels, which takes us well beyond traditional option pricing techniques. You may recall, in at least the options that I'm familiar with, there may be a few exotic options. Basically, the risk of the underlying security is assumed fixed. It's certainly not endogenously chosen. But in recognizing the problems introduced by Jensen and Meckling, we must allow for this possibility of an endogenously chosen risk level and still be able to value securities based on this. So I take a pretty simple approach. To allow for increasing risk resulting from asset substitution, I assume that the firm starts with a given risk sigma L, L is for low, but may at any time switch to a higher risk level sigma H should it wish to. It can switch back as well, and since I'm assuming there are no direct costs associated with that switching, presumably the easiest analogy to think of is a firm introducing derivatives as well as its own activities, and it could take some speculative positions in order to raise risk. Since risk management appears in the title of this talk, later on, let me just hold out as a carrot, we'll also talk about the ability to reduce risk. So at the moment, though, our mindset is on Jensen and Meckling worried about asset substitution. We start with a given level of risk, and we might be able to increase that level of risk. Should we? Would we? As a base case, I'm going to assume sigma L is the 20% I mentioned for firm asset risk, but it could, through the use of derivatives or just riskier activities, increase its annual standard deviation to 30%. Of course, in variance terms, that's more than doubling the risk of the firm. Now, I need to turn to the nature of what the optimal risk strategy looks like. Bear in mind there are these two levels of risk that the firm can switch between at any point. And it should be noted that in order for the agency problem to be an important one, it's after debt is in place that it's going to be making these risk switching decisions. It turns out that the firm's optimal strategy will specify a particular asset value, which I'll denote by V equaling VS for switch, VS, at which point it will change between the high and the low risk. And I've built enough time stationarity into my model so that this will be constant through time, this asset switching value. If the firm is restructured, then everything moves up, so it's still, relatively speaking, the same level. Okay, so if the asset value is above VS, the firm is doing well, following this random walk, we're above this level VS, the firm will choose the normal low-risk policy, sigma L. When asset value, however, falls beneath VS, the firm will be closer to default, and the firm will now raise risk to sigma H through asset substitution. That is to say, it will indeed increase risk and go for broke. Now, of course, we have to determine VS endogenously in this model. But for any VS, I've worked out the value for all the securities of the firm, including debt. And they don't look too different from what you saw before, except for the fact they're two different regimes, a high-risk regime when V is low and a low-risk regime when V is high. The higher the risk switching value VS, that means the more quickly, if VS is high, it means as V comes down, more quickly will you move to the risky strategy, and therefore asset substitution will take place more quickly, and the firm on average will have higher risk. Indeed, it's even possible in this model that VS, the switch point, should equal VU, which is the maximal value the firm ever gets, basically before it restructures, in which case the firm will always be below VS, meaning it will always operate at the high risk level. That was sort of the implication of Jensen and Meckling in discussing that. They said, well, when the firm has some risk in its capital structure, it will always choose a higher or high risk policy. And what we're going to find is that that's not true. Incidentally, if you go to a CEO of a corporation and say, you know, you should really raise your risk in order to take advantage of your debt holders, you don't get a very good reception. You might get a good reception if it's the savings and loans just before they go bankrupt. But until then, you generally don't. And I'm pleased to say, at least in that dimension, this theory seems quite realistic, because it does suggest that the firm only will want to exploit bondholders in extremis, namely when things are going bad. Okay. Now, we're going to consider three possible frameworks to look at, and then we'll see some numbers that will tell us what the firm does in these different frameworks. The first best regime is when the firm can credibly choose its risk strategy, i.e. this value VS at which it goes from high to low risk, ex ante, that is, before debt is issued. By credible, I mean that it would surely be followed after the debt has actually been issued, even if equity holders might subsequently like to change that policy. One such way of producing credibility is if the risk strategy could be specified in an enforceable contract, such as in a bond covenant. When the risk strategy can be pre-committed ex ante, the firm can maximize its total value with respect both to its risk strategy and with its capital structure. This could be called the first best set of choices for the firm. An interesting question, later answered, is whether the firm will ever choose to operate at higher risk in this first best case. Will it always choose the low risk all the time in the first best case? Answer, we'll see, is no. The second best regime is that emphasized by Jensen and Meckling. Here, the firm cannot pre-commit to a risk strategy before debt is issued. It will choose its risk level ex post, that is to say, after debt is in place. Now it will choose risk to maximize equity value. After all, the debt is sunk. It will maximize equity value rather than total firm value, incurring agency costs, because, of course, the bondholders will know that this is the case and charge a correspondingly fair rate of interest for the fact that they know risk will be chosen ex post. Now, it turns out that the difference in firm value between the first best case and the second best case becomes a quantitative measure of agency costs. And while our profession has thrown around agency costs as, quote, an important factor, we've never had really good information on how important agency costs might be. I'm not sure I have isolated the answer to that question, but at least in the context of this model and asset substitution, I can be precise about the magnitude of agency costs. Now, a third regime is when the firm has no risk flexibility whatsoever. It must keep risk at sigma L, the low risk, no matter how asset value V fluctuates. So this would be a firm that is either prohibited never to raise risk or simply it can't raise risk. If the first best regime never required higher risk, then the value of this third regime would coincide with the value of the first best. My paper permits the joint solution of optimal risk and capital structure policies to be solved. So let's look at some examples. We'll take a little bit of time to explain. Remember I said we have three cases. Here where the firm can commit to VS ex ante. It's called the ex ante case. Base case just refers to a whole bunch of parameters that are specified in the paper, and I'll ask you to take it on faith alone. They're kind of reasonable ones. Ex post is the Jensen-Meckling case where the firm sets VS ex post. It cannot pre-commit to a level. It therefore chooses VS to maximize equity value rather than firm value, and that gives rise to potential agency costs. And here's the case where the firm cannot change risk at all. It's basically the case where both sigma L and sigma H coincide at 20%. Now, the first column with the little v is my rather unhappy notation for total firm value. It's not asset value. It's asset value plus the value of leverage. Asset value is normalized to 100 here for these examples. V0 equals 100. But with leverage and the optimal risk strategy, in the first best case, v in this example is 108.6. And it's using approximately 10-year debt by assumption for these examples. Now, notice that it goes bankrupt when asset value falls all the way down to a third of its initial value of 100. It restructures if asset value gets up to essentially double its initial value. That will trigger something worth paying that 1% transactions cost for. Its current value starts at 100 when asset value, when its total firm value is 108. But this firm will switch to the high-risk strategy. Even though it's a first-best solution, it will still choose to operate at high risk in the very narrow range before bankruptcy. Bankruptcy occurs at asset value 33.6, and it will switch to the high-risk policy at asset value 44.7. So between those two values, this firm, even though it's a first-best, will operate at high risk. Why is that the case? Well, at this point, it's not so much stockholders versus bondholders. It's stockholders and bondholders versus the government providing the tax benefits associated with leverage. They want to keep the option open. They want to avoid bankruptcy costs, and it actually can be helped by raising risk. Now, if the firm cannot pre-commit to switching risk or increasing risk only when asset value falls that amount, if we're in the ex post situation, if risk ever got down below 79.1, the equity holders would say, well, the heck with it, now I can exploit the bondholders, and tough luck. We cannot pre-agree to switch risk at 44.7. So in the second best, or moral hazard, or agency cost situation, the firm does switch risk much more quickly. It increases risk much more quickly. Asset value now only has to fall to 79. So we observe then that there is an agency problem. There is an asset substitution problem, and that the firm will be motivated to try to exploit the debt holder. However, the capital structure somewhat changes in this case. Note that ex post, the restructuring point here falls from 201 to 187, and with a little mathematics, one can look at a bound on expected first passage times, and the expected maturity of debt in the ex post case falls from approximately 5.6 to 5.2. So that's not a huge reduction in maturity, but one of the ways that firms try to control agency costs, first speculated by Barnea, Haugen, and Senbet, is that firms reduce debt maturity, and indeed we find that to be a reaction to the presence of the asset substitution problem. Okay. The other thing we notice is that leverage falls slightly from the ex ante case, so another way relative to the first best that you control agency costs is to reduce leverage. But surprisingly, relative to the firm that can never change its asset risk, you'll observe both the leverage ratio, LR, this column here. 42.7 is a firm that has no problem at all with agency. The first best solution increases leverage. The second best decreases leverage relative to first best, but still increases it relative to a firm with no agency cost. And I think that is not widely understood. However, those moves are rather small. The most important thing here is you'll notice that the yield spread, you probably can't read that, I can hardly read it, the yield spread rises from 48 basis points when there's no problem to 69 in the first best reflecting the higher leverage, but then it shoots up to 109 basis points in the second best solution. So we observe, remember one thing I said was yield spreads don't seem quite high enough in the traditional models as we deal with them. The presence or possibility of agency costs clearly raises the yield spread quite significantly into the ranges that we feel are empirically realistic. How big are agency costs? Well, it depends on how you measure them. I would argue the appropriate measure is the difference between first best when you can pre-contract and second best when you can't. And there we see it's the difference in firm value, which amounts as a fraction of value to just over 1.33%. On the other hand, if you measure agency costs relative to a firm that cannot engage ever in asset substitution, since this is a second or third best solution, we find actually that the fall in value is minuscule. It's only 0.2. It's less than 0.2%. So our conclusion from this set of examples is that the agency costs associated with asset substitution are really quite small. If the total benefits of leverage are in the order of 7%, then only 1% of that, or 1.33%, is lost to agency costs. Is this a victory for Modigliani Miller over Jensen and Meckling, that the tax explanation for leverage is much more important than the agency cost? Well, I'm not sure victory is an appropriate word to use. Quantitatively, I think we can say the tax effects are significantly greater than the agency cost effects. But in some dimensions, such as the impact on credit spreads, we cannot ignore agency costs. Okay, I have a couple of notes I'm going to skip over. I'll just tell you, one, why the option analogy that Jensen and Meckling used really isn't perfectly appropriate for coupon-paying debt, also some comparative statics, but those can be found from the paper itself. I want to now talk about risk management. It so happens that we can directly apply all the theoretical baggage that we've developed here, or collected here, to turn our attention to risk management. All we have to do is reinterpret the two levels of risk. We could assume that the low-risk regime holds when the firm is actually hedging, and the high-risk regime is the normal activity risk of the firm when it is not hedging. Thus, with straightforward reinterpretations, we can use the previous results to examine optimal risk management and its interaction with optimal capital structure. The interpretation of VS, which still remains the switch from low to high or vice versa risk, we now interpret as the optimal hedging switch point. When asset value is above VS, this critical level, it's appropriate for the firm to hedge and keep risk at the low level. When asset value, on the other hand, falls below VS, the firm should abandon the hedge and operate at normal risk sigma H. As we'll see, indeed, it might even want to use derivatives if that's its hedging. It might want to use those to speculate as well. So derivatives could both allow We could look at when derivatives might be used for hedging, but as we'll see in an example, they might also be used at other times to speculate. And again, speculation or increased risk always is going to be occurring as the firm gets closer and closer to bankruptcy, and the go for broke phenomenon becomes important. Our analysis of risk management in this context provides three benefits. First, we can isolate when it is optimal for the firm to hedge. Secondly, we can show how capital structure and gearing is changed by the ability to hedge. Third, we can understand exactly why hedging is beneficial and quantify those benefits. This latter point requires a bit of amplification. In the purest Modigliani-Miller world, no taxes, no nothing, hedging is irrelevant, just as capital structure is irrelevant. After all, investors can hedge for themselves. There's no benefit for the firm to be doing it explicitly for them, any more than there's a benefit for the firm to leverage, because individuals could do that, or a firm to become a conglomerate and lower risk in that way, because once again, individual investors can form conglomerates with their own portfolios. So we've got to go beyond the purest Modigliani-Miller world in order to explain corporate risk hedging. I think this comes as a bit of a surprise. Many corporate executives, I think, well, of course we're going to benefit if we reduce risk. Well, that's not quite so obvious. First of all, as indicated, maybe your shareholders, who hopefully you're operating for, can do this on their own. And secondly, don't forget, no risk, no return. So it's not, that's a bit flip, but it's not so clear that a firm is going to be benefiting its shareholders by reducing risk through hedging. We really need a good reason for hedging, and we have to understand what those reasons might be. For example, Stoltz and Smith in the 80s suggested several reasons why firms might hedge, given taxes and default costs. First of all, they proposed, it seems amazing, but they emphasized the convexity of the corporate tax schedule. And all of us familiar with Jensen's inequality realize that the expected return of a convex function of a random variable is greater than the tax at the expectation. And it is true if you face a highly convex tax, corporate tax schedule, you could reduce this leakage to the government by lowering expected taxes. However, realistically, the U.S. tax schedule is only convex at such low levels that it seems hard to believe that that could be a major incentive for risk hedging. The second and I think more compelling point that Stoltz and Smith made was that you could lower your bankruptcy costs and perhaps issue more debt, but they specified for a given amount of debt, you could lower your bankruptcy costs or expected bankruptcy costs if you reduce the likelihood of bankruptcy by reducing risk. It might be pointed out, some others note, that if debt is already in place, hedging will end up helping the debt holders, but not the equity holders. Indeed, those authors have concluded that a firm will never hedge ex post, or should never hedge ex post, when debt is already in place, because what you're really doing is improving the value to the debt holders. They'd love you to hedge, but that same increase in value to debt holders may end up being a decrease in value equity. That's sort of the opposite of asset substitution, as we earlier talked about. Well, what's the case? What do we find? Here is the case of no hedging, which we saw was when sigma H equals sigma L equals 20. Now, instead of being able to increase risk to 30% through asset substitution, panel A assumes that you can undertake a hedge that will reduce the volatility, the standard deviation, from 20% annually to 15. This obviously isn't the perfect hedge. We're not reducing it to zero, but we're reducing risk substantially. I look at three possibilities, the ex ante optimal, the ex post optimal, and the always hedge situation. And again, I hope you can read those numbers. Just to see here, the ex-ante optimal, the firm value is 109.7, 108.9, 109.0. So let's first of all compare ourselves with no hedging at all. Compared with no hedging, we find that the firm will benefit from hedging whether or not it can pre-commit to hedging. That is to say, in both the ex post and ex ante cases. Okay. Hedging benefits are about 2% of firm value when the hedging policy can be credibly pre-committed. Now, what do I mean by that? Before it issues the debt, the firm says, we will hedge, almost all the time. The debt holders say, great. And they charge a low price for debt. The firm can take on a lot of leverage because it's a low price. What can go wrong? The bondholders in the ex post case can say, you may say that you're going to do this, but we don't believe you. Why are you going to hedge when it's going to help us more than it's going to help you? And therefore, the ex post case, we are going to find it interesting that the firm hedges at all. Indeed, we find it does. It's interesting to see that they do hedge at all, but they're not going to hedge as much, as you might guess. They're going to abandon the hedge at a higher value more quickly. And the hedging benefits fall to 1.5% from 2% when there can be no pre-commitment. So about a quarter of the benefits of hedging are lost due to this agency problem of not being able to pre-commit. Even with pre-commitment, the firm will not hedge as it approaches bankruptcy. That is, at very low levels, a firm in the first best case with pre-commitment will abandon hedging as it gets very close to bankruptcy. This is, again, keeps the option going against the government and against the bankruptcy lawyers. With no pre-commitment, the firm will abandon its hedge earlier, as I've indicated, a value, asset value of 69.2 versus 48.6, reflecting the conflict between stockholders and bondholders. But it still will choose, without pre-commitment, it will choose to hedge much of the time, namely whenever the asset value is greater than 69.2. And it starts at 100, and the annual standard deviation of asset value is going to be less than, it's going to be 15% initially when it's hedging. So that's quite a ways. Most of the time, I think we would find it's going to be hedging. A pre-commitment to always hedging actually doesn't do so well. It creates less value by quite a bit than optimal hedging and is only slightly better than ex-post hedging. So if a firm could somehow credibly pre-commit always to hedge, it would improve things, but it would be far behind the optimal and only a little better than the second best ex post case. So that is, there isn't much of a benefit to a covenant that tells managers they must always hedge, because there are some circumstances where ideally, in fact, the firm should abandon hedging, and if they always hedge, they're going to miss that value. Optimal gearing ratio increases with hedging from 42.7% to 50%. Increased tax benefits from gearing provide most of the hedging benefit, not reduced bankruptcy costs or tax convexity. This then means that the earlier work on why firms, what are the benefits of risk hedging, have missed much of it. Risk hedging is valuable if you use it to optimally increase the amount of debt you take on. If you don't increase the amount of debt, the relative advantages of hedging turn out to be quite small. Debt and equity actually are only slightly less risky with hedging. How is that possible when asset risk has declined substantially? Answer, the firm takes on more gearing. More gearing makes both debt and equity more risky. That may sound like a contradiction, but think about it hard, you'll find out it's no contradiction at all. So even though we reduce the risk of the firm, the risk of both equity and debt tends to rise. Debt maturity is somewhat shortened from about 5.5 to 4.75 years. When we move to panel B, which allows the firm to hedge more completely, to lower risk from 20% down to 10%, we simply magnify all the effects we saw in panel A. and the benefits to hedging ex post rise to 3.6% from the number 1.44% we saw there. Panel C asks that final question, what if firms can either choose to use derivatives to speculate or to hedge? What will they do? Well, the answer is they'll actually choose to use them to hedge. That should be reassuring. As long as things are going well, there'll now be a different risk switching point than before. It's slightly higher. But when things go bad, then once again they speculate because they can go for broke even more completely. Here the assumption is you could either lower risk to 15% or through speculation raise it to 30%. It's a bang-bang kind of situation here. You'll all always be at one or the other. And the hedging benefits in the ex post case fall from the 1.44% when you could only use this to hedge to 1.02%. So you lose about a third of your benefits if you have no way that you can monitor managers to hedge versus speculate. Still, the good news is most of the time they will choose to hedge rather than speculate. In conclusion, I've got 2 minutes left, including the introduction time. Using extensions of option pricing methodology, we've looked at the joint determination of optimal risk strategies and optimal capital structure. In effect, Jensen and Meckling meets Modigliani and Miller. As suggested by Jensen and Meckling, it's important to look at the interaction between risk-taking and gearing. This can explain both asset substitution and optimal hedging or risk management. But as suggested by Modigliani and Miller, tax and default costs still are the prime determinants of capital structure. Agency costs typically, in this set of examples, are less than 20% of the benefits provided by the leverage effect of Modigliani and Miller. Hedging will be undertaken by firms even when debt is already in place and the firm cannot pre-commit to hedging. But less hedging will occur than when the firm can pre-commit to a hedging policy before issuing debt. The analysis suggests that we are on our way to being as precise about corporate finance issues as we've been pricing and hedging issues previously. Who knows? In another 10 years, we may eventually have a McKinsey or Vauxhall Center for Research in Corporate Finance, and again, we would be enjoying life as a financial economist. Thank you very much.
There is time for a few questions, so if somebody would like to ask one, fire away. Alex.
Essentially, this is maybe a little bit more of a suggestion than a question regarding the risk management interpretation of your model. Now, in that scenario, you mentioned options or derivatives in general to be used for hedging. Now, since you're explicitly using this type of methodology to solve your problem quantitatively, shouldn't it be also possible at the same time to endogenously derive the price of such hedges and incorporate those in the decision, and maybe this would adjust partly at least for the benefits of hedging in such a scenario, because your assumption is essentially that the firm can cost-free switch between different levels of risk. But it should be possible in your model to actually endogenously price the cost of hedging.
Well, when I say they can costlessly change, it doesn't mean you buy an option for free, of course. It means there is no net transactions cost, that not only are options fairly priced, but there are no additional costs associated with buying or selling. Clearly a major but typical assumption of financial economics. In the sense that I'm just assuming options or derivatives are fairly priced, in principle, they would already incorporate this kind of, you know, feedback reflecting the risks of the firm. Now, that's a pretty handy assumption for me to make, but somebody actually has to price the derivatives they're selling to this corporation fairly. And what you point out is that option pricing, when a firm may be changing its risk through time, et cetera, is itself an interesting and challenging problem. I can say that Klaus Toft, a former student at Berkeley, now at the University of Texas, actually he's now with Goldman Sachs. I hope he's coming back to academia. Klaus actually worked out the value of an ordinary call option on our earlier model of a levered firm. Because you see, if the underlying assets follow the logarithmic Brownian motion, the equity value will not. In fact, it's a much more reasonable process. In a Brownian motion, equity could never go bankrupt. Well, you know, firms do go bankrupt. Equity value goes to zero. And this is captured by these extended option pricing models. So I'm very sympathetic, although I hope you'll do the hard work, to take this kind of model of firm behavior and then say, what is a fair price for a derivative sold to such a firm?
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions? Well, okay.
The bank is described in terms of speculation. It's understandable in speculation. But in a corporation, I would have thought there was a certain amount of risk aversion and that they would go towards something like a corporate insurance type of approach. And in which case, as you get away from it, any risk of your bond staying fast, you've increased the risk. Now, maybe that's part of the exemption thing. But if you reverse the behavior and increase your risk as you as the probability of the bond, this whole thing goes down, what would that produce in terms of the curve?
Well, as I say, when you're getting close to the boundary of bankruptcy, you risk a couple of things. If you go really bankrupt, you're out of there as an equity holder. But if the firm continues to do well, then you continue to realize these benefits of leverage, potential benefits of leverage, and you avoid paying the bankruptcy cost. And in some sense, you're like an option when you're close to bankruptcy. You can walk away from the firm entirely, but you get to keep the upside if the firm can turn around. And that's very much like, I mean, just why did the S&Ls speculate when they get close to bankruptcy? They didn't suddenly become very conservative. If you could commit yourself ex ante, I would agree. There might be some question whether you'd want to buy a put option or something else that might provide you a level of protection. But what I found in this analysis is actually you can play the system. It's actually a benefit to be able, just like limited liability is a benefit to equity holders, the ability to raise risk actually and play this option for all it's worth is valuable. That's what my analysis showed.
Are there other questions? No. Well, maybe since it's just a couple of minutes, I could ask one. Thank you.
It's a friendly question.
You've told us today about your work, which helps us understand the pricing of bonds. And the beauty of it is that you get these exact prices and tell stories about debt-equity ratios as well. But perhaps not everybody in the audience has read the recent literature. So the main opposition, if you like, might be from the academic community, which hasn't shown the same concern for the pricing, the accurate pricing that you've done. We've seen this proliferation of work, essentially the modern agency type theory based on controlling managerial excess through the use of debt instruments and so on, and quite complex security design structures coming out. Now that works a long way away from the data and from precise pricing. I mean, do you think this is something that one day you can build into the framework, or is it something that you feel is just so off beam as far as pricing stories go that you should forget about it?
Well, I think that obviously these are important issues. Even if their magnitude is 1% or 2%, that's a lot of money. And can one design securities that can help eliminate those kinds of problems? I take the nature of securities as fixed here, so I don't look at optimal security design. It could be possible to embed other kinds of securities. After all, they're simply different kinds of contingent claims, and one might be able to do what you're suggesting, which is to design different kinds of payoffs that when we plug them into these models, we can not only value, but we can then see how the firm value changes in response to a different set of securities. If I have a criticism about agency literature, it's not that it hasn't provided us, I think, with some useful insights, qualitative insights. And those, as I tried to do in this paper here, the qualitative insight of the feedback between risk and gearing or leverage was key to my, you know, thinking. Obviously, Jensen and Meckling affected what I was doing here. So I guess I think it's very useful work in terms of qualitative advice, but you can't take those models typically and go into a corporate treasurer's office and tell them your leverage should be 28% or 42%. Now, when you're being precise, you can, of course, be precisely wrong. So Black and Scholes were not only precise, but they were very accurate, at least at the first level of approximation, and now some, sure, we understand it doesn't do a perfect job, the original models, but we've extended those as well. So there remains, of course, empirical testing of this theory to see, and it has some weird predictions. I mean, even without this moral hazard, for example, it says if government rates go up, then the credit spread on a firm that otherwise hasn't changed will actually become smaller. Most people think of credit spreads as sort of being a fraction of the underlying rate of interest. This says if the rate of interest is 6% and the credit spread is 4%, then when interest rates go up to 10%, governments go up to 10%, the credit spread will actually shrink to only 3%. So we need to test these, and believe it or not, there now appears to be, I mean, this was very exciting to me, there appears to be some evidence that that's correct. And that was a prediction that I thought, boy, this theory is going to go down right away because it's a very strong prediction, and I think it's a wrong prediction. But it turns out that it's right. We still have a lot more testing to go. I'm not the person who's going to do that. But I guess what I'm saying is we can be precise. We have to now check to make sure that we're being precisely right rather than precisely wrong. But I think these other elements can eventually be encompassed in a useful way into our models.
Well, I'd like to thank Hein for a very interesting lecture. And in the traditional way, ask you to thank him too. For those of you who are coming to the reception, it's upstairs in the senior common room. I dare say pretty much everybody's welcome. It's on the fifth floor.